The losses on the Hamdens were, I think the survival rate was around between 18 and 20%.
The survival rate?
Yeah.
Wow.
And a lot of those were lost, just went out on their sorties and stuff like that, and they basically just never returned. When they met any aircraft, enemy aircraft or anything like that, they always went for cloud cover. So that was the only way they could really escape.
Anyway, the German U-boat ports became happy hunting grounds for the Coastal Command later in the war, because they knew, and the Germans knew, that the only ports those U-boats could go to were the ones that were waiting for them in France.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. We're ready for takeoff.
Welcome to Extended's Coastal Command series. I'm Peter Johnson, and I'm your host for this chapter. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wings Over New Zealand podcast, and in this chapter we're going to look at the role of air crews from New Zealand. And I'm joined by Dave Homewood from the Wings Over New Zealand podcast. Dave, how are you?
Good, thank you, Peter. Nice to be on the show.
Great to have you here. You've played a really important part in developing this series, and it's really proving to be interesting. But you got to speak to David Duxbury and Don Wilkie. David, a mine of information, and a fabulous talk with Don.
Yeah, absolutely. When you first approached me about this series and asked me if I could look at the New Zealand angle of Coastal Command, I knew obviously that quite a number of New Zealanders had served in Coastal Command, but I suddenly thought, I don't really know anything about it. I haven't come across that many people who actually did serve. And obviously, most of them would have been Royal New Zealand Air Force members. So
yeah. So
instantly, I thought, David Duxbury, he's the absolute mine of information. He really is. He's a walking, talking encyclopedia of RNZF history. And so I contacted him and said, would you like to come on the show and talk about it? So we both sort of sunk our teeth into it and thought, well, this is really good.
The chat does go backwards and forwards a little bit, and we're going to start the episode off with you talking to David. But then we've also got a piece that we've put in the middle of your chat with David by Don Wilkie on 489 New Zealand Squadron.
Yes. Now, Don is he's actually an artist, an aviation artist, and he got interested in 489 Squadron's history whilst he was researching a painting. He's done a few paintings now for 489 Squadron, and he decided, I'm going to write a book. There is a book out there, or actually two volumes out there, but you just can't get hold of them. There's just none that's not available. So he decided, right, I'm going to make one that will be available. He's been researching for a couple of years now, and his book is very close to being published, and I've seen the manuscript, and it is incredible. It's got so many photos I've never seen before, and he's managed to, you know, really pull together an amazing history. So
fascinating.
489 Squadron was one of the strike wing squadrons. Yes, they started off on the Beauforts, and then they went to Hamptons, and then they ended up with the Beaufighters through to the end of the war on the strike wings. They were part of the Anzac wing for quite some time and doing a lot of coastal strikes and anti-shipping stuff around the European coast.
Yeah.
Quite an amazing story.
It is, and he talks so eloquently about the topic as well. So really enjoyed listening to that, and we're going to line that up shortly. But after that interview, we go back to David, and he gets his World War II archives out, to help you better understand the role of New Zealand in the conflict. And although there's a bit of rustle in the paper, it's a fascinating insight when he talks about some of the memos and letters that he's dug out of his archives. They're quite amazing.
Absolutely. I really appreciated that too. And that's the kind of guy that David is. You can ask him a question and it might take him 2 weeks to get back to you, but he always does. And that's because he's gone to the archives and he's been pulling out all sorts of stuff. He actually works as a volunteer in the the Air Force Museum in New Zealand, which is the Royal New Zealand Air Force's Museum. And he's an amazing researcher. So that was pretty cool. I'm sure in terms of numbers that of the 10,500 Kiwis that went to the RAF during the war, at least 10% of them must have gone to Coastal Command. And
I'd say probably more.
Yeah, it's probably more because they would have been spread around all the different Sunderland squadrons and Liberator squadrons Hudson squadrons. And
another thing I've always I'm surprised about, most people think that, you know, of all the people that were trained in Canada, they think pretty well all of them went to Britain and then to squadrons. In fact, both of those statements are false because, in actual fact, New Zealand got quite a few people back from the Canadian trainees too.
Yeah,
they got them as soon as they were trained. And of course, we wouldn't have been able to. And that was because New Zealand had agreed to give up training air gunners and air observers early in the war because Britain and Canada convinced us it was more economical to train them all in Canada, which in actual fact they did for most of the war. Although, of course, we sneakily started training our own navigators later in the war and air gunners, but never WAP AGs, funny enough.
Yeah.
We did train them at that very early part of the war. In fact, even the ones we trained here weren't wireless operator air gunners, but some of them were cross-trained. You know, they'd train them first as an air gunner and then or a wireless operator, then they'd cross-train them as an air gunner, so you got your WAP AGs that way. But yep, so a lot of the ones that we sent to Canada for training, I imagine the bulk went to Britain, you know, probably 80 or 90, probably 90% of them did. But some came back to New Zealand. But for instance, their Venturas, there were hardly any New Zealand Ventura pilots, PB1 pilots, that were trained in Canada.
Yep.
There are about two or three. Surprising, isn't it?
It is. An interesting thing is because they were doing Coastal Command type work in the Venturas. Those guys trained up. They would have trained in the twin engine. Was it Bobcat crane? They would have trained. Yeah, the crane. Yeah, they would have trained up in those and probably Ansons.
Because the Ansons, Ansons were used for pilot twin engine pilot training. As were what was the and Oxfords. Although the Oxfords that went to Canada were mostly training. I think in the early days, I think were training RAF pilots.
Well, that's the thing I was going to say is they would have got up to the stage of being a competent twin-engine bomber pilot and then they'd come back to New Zealand. But the ones who trained in Canada and went to Britain, some of them, quite a significant number, I'd imagine, got diverted up to, is it Prince Edward Island, I think it's called, on the northwest of Canada. And there was an actual big area there where they were training like general reconnaissance type stuff for Coastal Command. Those guys were picked out during their training to go there and become Coastal Command pilots.
Yes, I think they must have in the Canadian schools, they must have had a fair idea of where they, you know, roughly what proportions they needed for the ongoing campaigns. And
Well, just to get back to Coastal Command, can you give me a bit of a rundown on the two squadrons that the RNZAF had in Coastal Command? There was 489 Squadron and 490 Squadron. Let's start with 489.
Right, that was a very interesting squadron because, of course, when it was formed, nobody seemed quite ready to form it. I've got some good documents dated 42, and they were one of the big ones in London was called Plans, and it was all based on projections done probably 18 months earlier. They said we're going to form. This was about middle of 42. They said we're planning to form eight new flying boat squadrons for the Indian Ocean Theatre, and one of them was 490 Squadron. Although they didn't actually know it at the time and they said that each of these will have nine aircraft or six plus three, I think it was, and they didn't actually give the strength of the air crews, but they said that they'll have more or less one crew for every aircraft in the squadron. And it gave these rough projections for the date. They hope that the convoys taking out the ground staff and the heavy machinery and so forth would arrive at their destinations, and then they hope that the air crew would be, often they were converted in Britain in those days. Like Britain had a flying boat OTU in where was that now? 6 OTU, and they had all old stranry of flying boats, old biplanes, and they had some Catalinas. And anyway, it was about all bringing all these streams of equipment and personnel from all the bloody distant corners of the planet had to come together and form these squadrons on an appointed day. That was,
yeah.
So it was a huge job just coordinating all this stuff and those tables, which included 490 squadron. But it was interesting that they did actually, you know, give the strength of the squadrons. They mentioned crews, but they didn't even mention the ground staff, apart from the fact that they had a ship booked to take them to their operational station.
Okay. Getting back to 490 Squadron, they formed in June 1943 at Dewey in, what's now Sierra Leone. It was West Africa back then, near Freetown, with Catalinas. And, they were basically just patrolling out into the Atlantic.
Yep, they were part of the anti-submarine, the Allied around the world anti-submarine network, trying to keep those U-boats on the hop.
Do you know, they didn't actually ever sink any U-boats, did they? I don't think they did. I think they attacked one and damaged it, but I don't think there were any sinkings for 490.
But yeah, I think it was a fairly quiet area for most of the period that 490 was there.
Yeah, exactly. I've interviewed Stan Walker, the late Stan Walker now. He was the last living Sunderland pilot from the squadron. And he said that in all the patrols he did, he never, ever saw anything. So, you know, it was a quiet region, which is probably testament to the fact that these guys were patrolling every day, that the Germans didn't go near there.
Yeah, and of course the Allies had the priceless advantage at that stage, of course, of having... Even when it was formed in 1943, the Allies are slowly getting the better of the submarines.
Yeah,
they're starting to get on top then, even if they didn't realise it quite as much as their successes were gradually, they were coming to grips with it and starting to really put the squeeze on the U-boats.
So with 490 Squadron, the Catalinas got replaced in 1944 with Sunderlands, Mark III Sunderlands, and would that have made much of a difference to their capability or?
Because the Sunderlands were somewhat faster, of course, on patrol, so they cover a bit more ground. Well, I think the Catalinas had longer endurance, which is often valuable.
Yes.
Particularly if you're trying to hunt a U-boat and it sort of keeps hiding from you and you can just keep mooching around.
I guess the Sunderland would have been a bit more comfortable to be, there's a lot more room. Yeah, lot more room to move around and... Well, you know, in a long patrol, if you want to get up and walk around.
But as you said, it was rather a quiet part of the ocean. But, you know, that was still a part of the ocean that had to be watched, and that was their job. And they just had to stay there. Did they? I think it was the only... Was it the only squadron at that station?
I think it was. Well, the squadron, 490 Squadron, actually had detachments. And I was just looking here. They formed on the 28th of March, 1943, at Dewey in... what's now Sierra Leone. But the same day, the squadron had a detachment at RAF Stranraer. And I guess...
Because all the crews did their OTU training at I think it was Stranraer.
They did train up in it's Scotland, isn't it, Stranraer, I think? It's...
Yeah, well, they had to ship out their ground staff ahead of them. As it showed in that timetable, it actually gave it, once they were set up there, even just partially set up there, then and the crew was finished their trainings in Scotland or wherever it was, they would meet them. The boats would follow them out.
Well, just getting back to these detachments, David. The list here it actually says from June 43, which is only 3 months into the squadron's existence, right through till the end of when they were disbanded in August 45, they had detachments at Fisherman's Lake in Liberia, Apapa in Nigeria, Abidjan in Ivory Coast, and Bathurst at Gambia.
Oh, yes.
They had these detachments, which would they have been an aircraft each, or what would that have been?
They could be one, two. They probably took a few extra ground staff with them. Of course, yeah. As you know, the crew of a Catalina also had several technical tradesmen aboard, like the waist gunners, for instance, you know, WAIST, of course. The waist gunners were called tradesmen air gunners, and they would be engine fitters or mostly engine people, I think. But they could do minor inspections and things, or minor rectifications of faults.
So just thinking about that, they had the main base and then four detachments, which each may have had at least one aircraft. That spreads out the fan of what that squadron was covering. And I guess if each of those different Sunderland squadrons that were along the coast of Africa were doing that, that covered a huge area. It really did, and it makes sense. It makes sense to have those detachments like that, so that they're not all flying from the same base every day, sort of thing.
No, well, it's complete opposite of a bomber squadron. Yeah.
Even
bomber squadron, or actually often torpedo bomber squadrons.
So with 489 squadron, they operated the Hampton until November 43, and those were replaced by the Beaufighter. And I think that's the Beaufighter that
everyone remembers.
Yeah, there's a lot of photos of them around. And then what people have forgotten is that, it's after the end of the war in Europe, in June 45 through to August, they operated the Mosquito.
That's right. But of course, June is post-war.
Yeah, exactly. So the Mosquito's been forgotten too, because it didn't really go into action with them. But
it never went into action, no.
But they did use them. Yeah. Well, there's a book coming out fairly soon. I've seen the manuscript written by Don Wilkie on the squadron, and he has got hundreds of photos. I don't know where he's found them all, but they are absolutely brilliant. It's going to be a really good book. It's a nice, thick book with lots of photos, so keep an eye out for that one. Well, I want to welcome to the show Don Wilkie. Hi, Don.
Hi.
Now, you've been working on a book on number 489 New Zealand Squadron, which was a coastal command squadron, for the last couple of years, haven't you?
Yeah, I started probably researching it back in 2012.
Right.
Last June, I actually started putting everything together, and that took over a year to type it all up. And I went around New Zealand meeting different families. I got amazing response from those people, and spent a lot of time down at the Air Force Museum.
Yep.
And the book's now with a person doing the editing and
proofreading
on the whole book.
Yep.
Yeah, proofreading of it.
Yep.
And it worked out so far. The book's running around about 550 pages.
Yeah, it's a massive book. I've seen the manuscript that you showed me, and it looks fantastic. So many photographs, so many completely unseen photographs. So it's going to be a brilliant book, and it really will cover part of New Zealand history that hasn't been adequately covered before, because, you know, there has been a book on the squadron before, but it's never been available to the public, which is a rather strange setup. So this one's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, one of the things in doing books, this is my, I've got another book on the go, but this is my second book. The first book I did was on local history on Port Arthuriri.
Yep.
And Napier. That was a pictorial history book. And I just feel as though a lot of the photographs in the book are the actual crew members. And yep. And the raids they did, along with obviously the aircraft. But to me, that actually paints a better picture of the squadron that people can actually relate to better, because then they see the names in the text, but then they've got the photographs of the people that I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that. So let's start at the beginning and talk about how number 489 squadron formed in the first place, and where they formed, and what they were flying.
Okay, the squadron was formed by Coastal to be part of Coastal Command, and that was on the 12th of August 1941 in Lectures in Scotland. Right. The squadron spent probably 90% of its time based in Scotland. Did a couple of forays back into England.
Yep.
And but it spent most of its time in Scotland. A wing commander, I think it's James Brown, an Englishman. He was the first one to set up the squadron, and it was up to him to get it operational. The first two wing commanders were both English. Both ran the squadron with pre-war regulations, which didn't go down too well with the Kiwis.
Yeah.
And the first two flight commanders of A and B flight was a squadron leader, Bernard Sandbin, and George Evans. And they the squadron was then split up into two wings, basically.
Two flights.
Yeah, two flights, yeah.
Yeah. So right at the beginning there, they were flying the Handley Page Hampden, weren't they?
No, they weren't. The very first plane they flew was, they were given Beauforts, and they were given four of those to try and train with.
Yep.
That caused a little bit of a problem because the crews started to get quite dissatisfied with the whole thing because of the lack of aircraft. And one Kiwi crew member actually wrote to the High Commission the New Zealand High Commission in England.
Yep.
And he complained about the situation, said they might as well be in the Pacific War rather than the European War. And he came up and saw the squadron, and then not long after that, the Beaufighters were taken away and they're given Blenheims
right.
to fly, but they were quite old. And then in February 42, the whole squadron was transferred through to Thorney Island and near Portsmouth on the coast.
Yep.
To retrain, and that's when the Hamdens came in.
Ah, right, okay. So they went from Beaufort to Beaufighter. No.
No.
They went from Beaufort to Blenheim and then onto the Hampden, did they actually fly operationally in the Blenheim? Were they doing ops in the Blenheim, or was it mainly just training?
No, they're doing mainly practice. It was all practice flying and training on the Blenheims. And yeah, then they went to, it wasn't until they got into the Hamptons that they actually started, once they'd finished the training there, they went operational in those.
Did the crews think that the Hampden was a better aircraft to be flying, or?
They thought it was obsolete. I think I've got, there's one comment that when they discovered that they had Hamptons, in some of the diaries and memoirs that I've actually gone through, some people say they were really pleased to get Hamptons. Yeah. Others weren't very happy at all. It was basically an obsolete bomber from the RAF handed over to Coastal Command. But one bloke turned around, and one of the crew members, and they said about the cramped interior of the aircraft, and said to the effect of, I'll read this out, if one's footing slipped, it may be the end of his wedding tackle being rendered useless. Wow. So the aircraft itself wasn't that complimentary. It was slow, sluggish. It was adapted to carry torpedoes, but the bomb doors, for example, wrapped itself around the torpedo rather than closed properly.
Okay.
So the thing was designed somewhere in around 1935 by a German bloke, and right. it wasn't very successful at all.
Were they carrying torpedoes exclusively, or did they also carry bombs or depth charges or any other armament in the Hampden?
No, I think it was in the Hamptons. It was basically all always torpedoes. Yep. Maybe an occasional ones where they were bombed up, ready to go on sorties, but 90% of it was all torpedoes.
Okay, okay. So with the New Zealand squadron, how did Coastal Command integrate New Zealanders with the Brits? Because it wasn't exclusively Kiwis, was it, on the squadron?
No, the ground crews and the air crews were basically mixed. And I think away from the hierarchy, everybody got on very well together. I know that there was a couple of comments from the English that they really enjoyed being with in the New Zealand squadron. It was a lot more relaxed than what the RAF squadrons were. I know there was a comment where one of the pilots in one of the manuscripts I read that he was fed up because he walked 50 paces and had to salute five or six times, and he thought it was just a waste of energy.
Yeah.
But that was under the English wing commanders. They were quite stickler for the things like that.
Right. Yeah, it's a funny thing. The Kiwis were, and I think the Aussies too, were always a little bit more relaxed on the discipline.
I think the Australians were worse than the Kiwis, actually.
Yeah, that's probably true. So what was the sort of range that they were flying the Hamptons? Where were they flying from and to on an operational mission when they were and were they seeking out convoys and shipping?
Yeah, they first went operational at St Ives down in England, and they were doing along the French coast down to Spain and back. And then when they fully became operational up in Scotland, they were doing all along the Norwegian coast. So each of their trips might have been 4 or 5 hours.
Wow.
Plus. So it wasn't, you know, they're quite long sorties.
Yeah, in a cramped aircraft.
Yeah.
In a slow aircraft.
Yeah, very slow. Yeah.
Yeah. And were there a lot of losses?
The losses on the Hamptons were, I think the survival rate was around between 18 and 20%.
The survival rate?
Yeah.
Wow.
And a lot of those were lost, just went out on their sorties and stuff like that, and they basically just never returned.
Okay. Wow.
The weather was a main thing for it, where some of the weather they went out and was absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
One of their biggest, when they met any aircraft, enemy aircraft or anything like that, they always went for cloud cover. So that was the only way they could really escape.
Wow. You're basically saying that 80% of their aircraft got wiped out, never came home.
I suppose that's the case. It wasn't until they got to the bow fighters that their survival rate increased dramatically, and that went up to, I think, about 30%. But the actual, they're always having influx of new people all the time, but the losses were quite horrendous.
Yeah, that's way more significant than I was actually expecting. So that's incredible when you think about it. I mean, very brave men go into war in obsolete and slow, terrible aircraft. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, to me, I thought that they were incredibly brave. There was a thing where later on, when they're in one of the bow fighter crews, he mentioned in his book the fact that he never apologised for all the parties they had. And when you think about it, why should they? Because they never they went out one day and they on a sortie, they never knew whether when they're coming back or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a bit like a bomber cruise, really.
Yeah.
Their survival rate was shocking.
Yeah. So you mentioned that they spent most of their time in Scotland. So can you talk about the different Scottish bases that the squadron was based at?
Well, the first one they went to, where they started off, was Lucas. That was very much a base that was built pre-war. So it had really nice accommodation and everything like that.
Yeah.
When they came back, from training and first came back to came back from Thorny Island. They went to a place called Wick, and that had airfields of Tane and another place, but Tane and it was just tents when they landed at Tane.
Okay.
Wick was very, very crammed because they had quite a few other squadrons, different type of squadrons based there.
Yep.
So that was really cramped. They went through, then they went back to Lucas, and then they went to Langham and Dalkey, I think is, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong.
Yeah.
They were better, far better squadrons, you know, airfields that they went to.
Now, the squadron got formed into a strike wing alongside an Australian squadron and a British squadron, and I think at one point it was a Canadian squadron, wasn't it? When did that happen that they all started working together?
When they started working together, it was about 43, I think.
Okay.
And it was called the Anzac Squadrons.
Okay, yep.
And that was down in, that started down in Langham.
Now, at that stage, were they still with the Hamptons, or was it?
No, they had transferred over to Bowfighters by then.
Okay, yep.
At Langham, they did a lot of sorties along the French coast near the Frisian Islands and places like that.
Yep.
There's quite an interesting story with the Bowfighters down in Langham. They had nose cameras in the aircraft.
Okay.
And they came back from one sortie and they developed the films from it, and then they decided to have a film evening, and the start of the movies, everyone was yahooing and everything like that as the planes went in to strike the ships. And there were some near misses in the films of the aircraft from the films. And by the time the filming had finished, the whole squadron was dead quiet. And they decided after that it wasn't a very good idea to show these movies anymore. So never showed them. Right. I think reality sort of set in while watching the movies.
Yeah. I guess that's a really good point, because in the action, there's too much going on to take in what's actually really happening, but you view it afterwards. Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of it's when they went in, a lot of it was just pure adrenaline. There was a bloke that said that there was when they're going out on these sorties, and this is during the bowfighter period, there was two hours of apprehension, 15 minutes of absolute pure adrenaline, and then 2 hours of total boredom going back home.
Absolutely. And can you talk a little bit about the armament and the tactics between when they had the Hampton and then later when they had the Bowfighters?
The Hamptons were just basically, they had a one machine gun at the front.
Yeah.
A rear two rear turret with and they were just 303 Brownings. And then they had the torpedo bombs. The Bowfighters had 20mm cannons. And they either carried bombs or torpedoes. The Bowfighters for the Kiwis, they never used rockets. The Australians and English squadrons used rockets.
Yeah.
When during the Bowfighter time, when the Kiwis went out on a sortie, they could go out with four or five Bowfighter squadrons, and they could be anything up to 30 aircraft going out on a sortie. If the Kiwis weren't carrying torpedoes, they were the strike aircraft that sort of raked the ships with cannon.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. And of course, it should be also mentioned that within the strike wing and all the other different strike wings, there were Kiwis serving on the other squadrons as well. So some of those guys would have used rockets in their careers, but just not this particular squadron.
No, Kiwis never had rockets.
Yeah, not on the squadron, yeah.
Yeah. This Kiwi squadron, yeah, 489, never had rockets. They, as I said, they either used torpedoes or bombs, or in the bow fighters, they had cannons.
Yeah. And so when they were making an approach towards a ship, I mean, you see the footage, and they seem to, there's a lot of diving going in. I always thought that torpedo bombing was, you know, low level, sort of flat, but you see a lot of, from the footage, you see a lot of them diving in. So I guess that's probably just the strafe, more of the strafing that you were talking about. And they'd have to get low level.
More the strafing. And I think with the, there was a set formula for dropping torpedoes. I think was, it was a set speed, 120 feet above the water and X amount of feet or yards from the, I think it was 1,000 feet from the ship before they dropped the torpedo.
Right.
When they rockets and 20 millimeter, they just dived in.
Yep. Okay. And so I guess it'd be preferable to be the guy doing strafing or whatever than, or rockets, than being the guy that's having to fly a straight line level with a torpedo. It must have been, you know, quite a thing to do that day after day.
There's in my book I've actually written from diaries and manuscripts. You know, quite a few of the manuscripts I had have been unpublished, but they actually go into detail of some of these raids and dropping torpedoes and things like that. There's one there with a Hampden where they went in and they flew over almost at mast level, going over top of the ship.
Yeah.
And one of the crew members stuck his pistol out and started firing at the crew on the deck.
Wow.
That's how close they came.
Wow.
And it was exactly the same when they went into doing the cannon strafing. They went in very close there.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, incredible. So what other interesting stories have you picked up along the way about the squadron with, you know, Kiwi involvement?
There's been quite a few. There's one that where a bloke never actually got a medal, which he should have, and the only reason why he didn't get the medal was because I think he was captured for POW.
Yep.
excuse me. His name was Guy Gaskell, and he was a crew member of Flying Officer Richardson's aircraft. And they came into drop down to do a torpedo, but Richardson had a problem with he was a pilot. He had a problem seeing out the windscreen because the machine gun at the front of the Hampden, they oiled up. While they're on base, but they meant to clean it all out before they, the ground crew meant to clean it all out before they took off.
Yeah.
And all the oil from the machine gun had got over the windscreen. And Gaskell actually climbed out on top of the aircraft, no parachute because they had chest parachutes, no safety line, and crawled across the top of the cockpit and wipe the windscreen.
Wow.
500 feet above the ground. And then he sort of crawled back in, and they were coming into an attack, an 11,000 ton ship. And they actually got hit in the engine and ended up by crashing in Norway. And got captured by the Germans. But it's another duplicate of Ward with his VC.
Yeah, James Ward, yeah. That's incredible.
yeah. But Richardson tried to get him recognised for his bravery. and after the war, but nothing was there, nothing seemed to have been done about it. But to me, that's quite amazingly heroic, because the Hamdens was basically called a flying suitcase because it was so thin and horrible. Here's another description of a bloke, an interview with a bloke, Jolly. He was talking about the tactics of the bow fighters, and especially when they were flying down the Frisian Islands, where they had, you know, up to 30, 35 bow fighters.
Yeah.
And normally when they're flying, they're all flying sort of in a set, sort of like set formation. And when they were going to turn, the leader always gave warning that they were turning, so they'd actually start spreading themselves out to be able to turn. And in this particular case, they, the person actually in, head of the raid, he's either a, an English or Canadian squadron leader or wing commander. He immediately just said, right, we're turning port. And he said he watched, you had to watch the aircraft on your right and then on the left. And he says, and as they turned, you watched the aircraft on his left, about three across. And as the all the aircraft turned, this one got lower and lower and lower. And he said, then he said he saw some puffs in the sea coming off the props. And the plane, and the bow fighter kept flying, and the props just took off and spun off the aircraft.
Oh.
And within about 30 seconds, the next thing, the bow fighter banged straight into the sea. And it just went straight in and was lost. And that's because of the fact that they nobody was given warning to that they were going to be turning.
Right, right, right. Oof. Yeah. Amazing. Overall, do you think that the Coastal Command made a difference in the war? Was the shipping that they were attacking, was it a big part of the winning of the war? And
oh, I think it was worth it. Shipping along the Norwegian coast and stuff like that, because that was one, that's what those ships were taking all the iron ore to Germany, to the factories, so they could build their tanks and aircraft and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it got, and is obviously had a major effect, because by the time they hit the flying bow fighters, the ships were trying to sail at night and then go and stop in a fjord during the day, right up hard against the cliffs of the fjord, and then come back out at night again, because the rates that the ships were being sunk was causing a major effect to the German war effort.
Right.
Now the Hamdens themselves, when they finished with the Hamdens and swapping over to the bow fighters, the Hamdens had sunk over 30,000 tons of shipping, and 36,000 tons of shipping, yeah, and damaged over 30,000. So, you know, they definitely did a major job.
Yeah. So do you think that these guys are remembered well enough these days, and particularly in New Zealand? I almost feel like the whole Coastal Command effort has been forgotten.
I definitely think that. One of the reasons why I started writing this book is that I started... I do oil paintings, and and the bow fighter is my favourite aircraft, so I wanted to relate it to the Kiwis, you know, to New Zealand.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up by finding out about the 489 Squadron. And Burroughs had written his first book then, but that was a private book, just solely for the squadron. And it was incredibly hard to find out anything about the squadron or the crewmen, the crews. And that's what's really made me decide that I wanted to write a book and on the squadron that could be made out to, out for the public themselves.
Yes. Yep.
And as I said, it's been very, very difficult to get names of the different crews or families, get in contact with the different families. I've managed to get in contact with about 15.
Yeah.
But it's been incredibly difficult. But the ones I have got in contact with have been absolutely amazing and just opened up all their father's memoirs and grandfather's memoirs and things like that, and with all the photographs and things like that. It's just been absolutely incredible.
Excellent. Well, I'm really looking forward to when your book actually gets published and comes out, because it's going to be, it'll be something that'll fill a gap for a start, but I think it's going to be a really interesting story as well.
Yeah, well I think it's basically told totally through a first person, from the diaries, memoirs and logbooks and things like that. I've done no summary of what I think actually happened or anything like that. I've left it totally up to the 489 crews themselves.
Yes.
And I think that's slightly different to others that have done, and also the fact that the amount of photographs. I think in total there's about 1,200 photographs throughout the book.
That's incredible.
And I'm trying to get the Air Force Museum to actually publish it. Like, what I'd like to do is actually give them the manuscript.
Yeah.
And organize the printing of it, but then they take over the whole thing and they sell it and keep profits for the museum itself.
Right.
But if that doesn't happen, I'll self-publish it myself.
Right. Well, well done on doing this amazing project. And I know it came out of one of your art projects, and your paintings are fantastic. I always enjoy seeing your Air Force related paintings, and I've seen the manuscript of the book, and I know it's going to be really interesting. So, yeah, thanks very much for taking part, Don, and helping us remember a little bit of Coastal Command.
Yeah, well, I think they definitely should be remembered, because I think they sacrificed a huge amount for the for us, for later generations.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Yep, no problem at all. Thanks very much.
No worries.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. Just as Extended is currently expanding your knowledge of RAF Coastal Command, you might be keen to widen your aviation history horizons in other directions as well. Did you know, for example, that around the time the Short Sunderland was entering RAF service, Shorts were breaking with their flying boat traditions and planning a long-range advanced land plane airliner? The project was halted on the outbreak of war, but you can read all about it in our latest edition, TAH 37. Did you also know about the British South Africa Police Reserve Air Wing, established in 1957, in which farmers and businessmen flew anti-guerrilla missions in their own civilian light aircraft, fitted with door-mounted machine guns and homemade grenade chutes? Or that Italy's mighty Isotta Fraschini Asso 750 aero engine, an 18-cylinder broad-arrow monster introduced in the early 1930s, which developed 850 horsepower, is still in production as a marine engine today, 90 years later. You can read in depth about all of this in issue 37 of The Aviation Historian and extend your knowledge. We're print, we're digital, but we're not on sale in newsagents. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com.
Well, should we move on to probably who was the most famous New Zealander flying in Coastal Command, and that was Lloyd Trigg, Flying Officer Lloyd Trigg, who joined the RNZF. He trained in New Zealand and Canada, went to Britain, ended up on 200 Squadron flying Hudsons, and I think he did 45 or 46 operations. West Africa. He was in West Africa. Yeah, and doing reconnaissance patrols in Hudsons, doing exactly the sort of thing as what our Hudsons were doing here, basically, and He did 46 operational patrols as a captain, as a first pilot. Then he was sent to convert to the Liberator, and he was on his very first patrol with his crew in a Liberator 5 and flying out of Yandum in West Africa, which is now in the Gambia, and it's apparently called Banjul now. But this operational patrol on August 11th, 1943, him and his crew happened to find the German submarine U-468, and they made an attack, and the submarine fired at them with their anti-aircraft guns and completely shot up the Liberator. Basically, it was fatal for the aircraft. But yeah, but Trigg continued his attack and dropped his depth charges and sank the submarine as well as the submarine shooting up the aircraft. And the aircraft crashed and everybody on board was killed. And
mutual destruction. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And interestingly, the crew who survived from the U-boat, they managed to survive only because the life raft from the aircraft popped up to the surface.
That's the most amazing part of the story,
isn't it? It's just so lucky.
If that raft hadn't popped up, we would never know the story.
Nobody would ever know it. And later, a Sunderland happened to see that raft, recognised it as an Allied one, and alighted and picked them up. But it found out that they were all Germans on board, and it included the captain of the U-boat who had survived, Oberleutnant Clemens Schamong, I think it is. And and he recommended the Victoria Cross for Trigg, and that's how he was awarded it. It was the captain of the U-boat that he sank recommended him for the highest award.
I think that's unique in the history of the Victoria Cross too.
I believe so. Enemy.
But yeah, that's a fantastic story, isn't it?
It is. It's a unique story, and it's a sad story because Trigg and his crew were lost, but it's one of those ones that, you know, he's still remembered in the RNZF today, along with the other two VCs.
It's a great story. Yeah, it's as you say, it's pretty amazing and unique.
Yeah, and also the coincidence that a Sunderland happened to see them too. I mean, there's no guarantee once you're in your raft that you're actually going to get found by anyone.
No, quite right. Yeah, there's coincidence on coincidence.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Well, here's how they form up a squadron, Dave.
Okay.
A signal to Air Headquarters Wellington from the New Zealand liaison officer at the Air Ministry. 11th of August, blah, blah, for your information. 489, repeat 489, RNZF Torpedo Bomber Squadron will commence to form in UK 12th of August. Aircraft will be Beauforts. That's all they knew in New Zealand. Yeah, this is of some interest when you're talking about how they divided up crews into what they were going into. Document dated October 41 to the New Zealand Air Liaison Officer from somebody in the Air Ministry. October 41. I have discussed this matter at length with DP2. That'll be a person in the Air Ministry. I have to report that a definite policy has been laid down which should improve the position until, in due course, New Zealand squadrons should be manned completely by New Zealand personnel. And, of course, you and I know that, in fact, that never happened. Article 15 squadrons never were all New Zealand, although some were largely New Zealand aircrew, particularly the fighter squadron. In future, all New Zealand bomber pilots and aircrew will be posted from the PRC to number 11OTU of Bassingbourne, where they will train on Wellingtons and be crewed up at the appropriate point in their OTU course. A New Zealand Torpedo Bomber Squadron. Yeah, it's in Scotland. This squadron was formed from the Empire Air Training Scheme and is training hard under the guidance of a wing commander from Australia and a squadron leader and squadron leaders from Scotland and Wales. It began simply, so simply that few on the station in Scotland realised that it was there. Three officers arrived one day and reported that they had come to start the squadron. The senior officer, squadron leader B.J. Sandyman, a Scotsman in the Royal Air Force, had built up a new bomber squadron in 1936, a resuscitation of one which existed in the last war. In this new RNZF squadron, he had to create something with no history or tradition. Terrible crime in Britain, but he had the certainty that the squadron would one day be striking with the robust vigour of New Zealand against the menace of the Nazi. Until a sufficient number of New Zealanders arrived, it was decided to supplement the strength of the squadron from Royal Air Force personnel. A number of officers and men from an experienced Beaufort squadron were posted to it. four of the officers and half of the air crew being New Zealanders. The commanding officer, who had been in Australia, seconded to the Royal Australian Air Force, arrived about this time. He is Commander J.A.S. Brown, Royal Air Force, a pilot of wide experience, and he took over with enthusiasm and drive. Beauforts arrived and flying training was begun. New Zealanders joined the squadron singly and in groups. Some came from training schools in Canada, others had been taught in their own country. One of the tasks that was to find an active interest and flying practice was not possible. Boxing team was formed and New Zealanders played in the station rugby team and soon constituted a third of the 15. When flying practice began, it was confined almost entirely to pilot. They had to get used to the Beauforts. Then, as pilots obtained their navigators, wireless operators and air gunners, they dropped practice bombs on a dummy ship in a field. They flew over the sea with dummy torpedoes, went for trips over land and sea so the pilots and navigators could learn to work together. The Royal Navy lent them a ship and said that they could try and torpedo it with torpedo camera guns, though, and not with genuine torpedoes. Now the flying hours of the squadron are mounting. New Zealanders are steadily reporting for duty. 28 of them, all gunners or observers, turned up in one day. The squadron is now really a New Zealand one. Yeah, this is the beginning of 490 Squadron, actually. It's a from the Air Ministry, Bush House, South East Strand, London, WC2, 20th of July, 42, to Wing Commander FR Newell, Freddie Newell, who was our liaison officer there at Adastral House. Between now and December, we shall be forming some GR, General Reconnaissance, flying boat squadrons, or on Catalinas for service in the Indian Ocean area. We cannot at present say how many will actually be located in India. I should be glad to have your views as to whether any of these should be New Zealand Article 15 squadrons. Yours sincerely. So they actually asked us if we were interested in being a...
Well, that's interesting, because we never ended up in the Indian Ocean at all.
Not really, no.
It was the Atlantic.
You see, there's these sort of forward planning. I mean, we're only September 42 here, but so it's only a few months. But I think they started forming up crews for the Catalinas, were being trained up from early sort of April 43, I think. And, of course, the ground crew went out ahead of them too. So they got there first out to Jue, or however it's pronounced.
Yeah.
Under Article 15, blah, blah, number just announcing 487 Squadron at this stage. Number 487, repeat 487 Ventura for service UK end of August. Commanding Officer, Wing Commander, FC Seville, New Zealander in the RAF. Number 490, repeat 490, Catalina Squadron for service Indian Ocean at end of December. Well, it took a bit longer than that, actually.
Yeah.
Personnel and equipment, sail from UK, aircraft to be dispatched February and March 43. Again, I think they were a little bit later than that. But so the formation date's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
To set it up, I think they have to have a headquarters formed to start with.
Yes. Interesting stuff.
If the flying boat squadron is satisfactory, then the third squadron will also be armed with Catalinas. Yeah, they were tossing up whether to use Catalinas or Sunderlands, I think. In order to meet the expansion detailed in paragraph above, it will be necessary to form a total of 8 new flying boat squadrons for service overseas. Number 321 Dutch Squadron, now in Ceylon, will be doubled in size to 12 plus 6 aircraft and will count as one of the extra squadrons. The air crew for this squadron will be provided by the Dutch from their own resources. The establishment of the ground personnel will be decided in consultation with a certain member of one of the directorates. It will be necessary, therefore, to dispatch ground personnel for only 7 RAF and Dominion squadrons. Equipment for 8 squadrons must, however, be sent. The numbers of the new squadrons and dates for dispatch of personnel and equipment and of IE aircraft are given below. Now, of course, IE aircraft are the immediate reserve aircraft, like a squadron establishment that consists of the initial equipment, IE, and then you have the immediate reserves. And that's generally you add them together and that gives you the squadron establishment. But sometimes you add on workshop reserves, or although they might be held at some other place. Dominion squadrons, 463 RAAF, previously earmarked as a heavy bomber squadron for Middle East, and number 490 RNZF squadron, Article 15 squadrons formed under the Empire Training Agreement. Although Dominion squadrons, they will be treated exactly as RAF squadrons for the purposes of the issue and accounting for equipment. If sufficient Australian and New Zealand personnel are not available to meet the establishment of these squadrons, then the balance will be made up by RAF personnel until such time as Australia and New Zealand personnel become available. It's about September, October 42.
Okay.
Well, it's well ahead of them actually forming them, although some were partially in existence anyway. Destinations of squadrons for Indian Ocean. Number 212 squadron will be located in northwest India for operations and the approaches to the Gulf of Oman. You see, they're trying to place squadrons within reach of areas, ocean areas of interest. 259 squadron will be located at Mombasa. It will be under the operational control of 222 group at Ceylon and under the administrative control of 207 group, as in the case of 209 squadron. Destinations of the remaining four squadrons will be notified later. That means they haven't worked them out yet. The expanded 321 Dutch squadron will be located in Ceylon. Well, here's what Coastal Command has to do for them. It's got all the different directorates and what their responsibilities are to make sure that all this stuff happens. Coastal Command headquarters, well, is to arrange training of crews and dispatch of aircraft in accordance with paragraph 4 above. In conjunction with Air Headquarters West Africa, arrange for the gradual rearming of numbers 95 and 204 squadrons. DDO to issue a secret organization memorandum. That just goes to show you that these, as far as the RAF are concerned, they were entirely under their command and administration. New Zealand doesn't really have to do anything except keep feeding their personnel into the Empire Air Training Scheme, and they'll eventually pop out somewhere along the line and turn up, and they'll be posted to the squadron's front line.
Yep.
Although another thing to remember is that I'm always surprised at the number of pilots, particularly sent to the United Kingdom, not only from New Zealand directly, but from Canada, who ended up at places they probably never even heard of. You've probably heard of pilot advanced flying units in the UK. Have you ever heard of them?
No, I haven't actually.
They would be equipped with airspeed Oxfords, and their job was to acclimatise pilots coming from overseas who often flew in sunshine and clear air and arrived in Britain in the middle of winter and it's all foggy and industrial smoke and there's billions of barrage balloons hemming in every airfield. There's billions of aircraft cluttering up the airspace. There's got to be radio silence and there's a bloody war going on all around you. And they had to, and British airfields and the exact procedures they had on, you know, it's they should have been pretty similar to what they'd been flying in New Zealand and Canada anyway. But again, a lot of people seem to be pilots or posted these. They'd stay there for months and months and months. And they think, what am I doing here? You know, I thought I was going to go to Lancaster's or whatever.
Yeah,
And here they were stuck with these. That was another one of these jobs that had to be done. And they kept doing that right through into 44, probably right to the end of the war, actually, because Britain was so crowded and hemmed in compared to New Zealand or particularly Canada or Australia, for that matter, because the Australians were going through the same systems as we were. Yeah, you might find, you know, 10% of them might have been of these contingents arriving from Canada or directly from New Zealand. They'll say, right, you're off to advanced flying units. And they probably all look at each other and say, what the hell are those?
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much how it worked. There's always people getting siphoned off for other duties. Whenever a fresh air crew arrive port for their first actual operational units, they might get a shock. You've got your wings, you know, you've been flying Cessna cranes and you're pretty pleased with the way you fly a twin and you're bound to be Bomber Command or maybe Coastal. You have a report to number 3 advanced flying unit, pilot advanced flying unit. Here's your rail warrant or something. And off you go. And saying, well, here I am going to a place I've never heard of, to a unit I've never heard of, to do a job of which I have absolutely no idea.
It's the Air Force. Just to close, David, just in a nutshell, what do you think was the overall impact of Coastal Command in World War II? And did it help to win the war?
Yeah, I think Sir Churchill said it all, and other people did it too, that they said, you know, well, as far as Britain was concerned, the Battle of the Atlantic, as they called it, but as they said, it went from when they declared war on Germany until 8th of May 45. It was the longest battle. There was no other battle like it. It was the most intense one, the one that Britain knew that the Germans, if they won the war of the convoys and sank them for the ships faster than they could be built or replaced, that Britain would be starved out, have to surrender. So it was probably Churchill's greatest worry. The survival of Britain meant that they could mount the invasion, for instance, from very close by. It was very handy, Britain's position, as it was right next to France.
Yeah.
But they had to win that battle. Otherwise, she was United States couldn't help them if Britain surrendered. That had to be won from Britain and from with particularly a lot of resources from the United States, of course, including a lot of the ships used and the Canadian ships too, because the Canadians were fully involved in the Battle of the Atlantic. All the U-boats were the training ground for the U-boats was the Baltic Sea, and their operational bases were in France. And so those the German U-boat ports became happy hunting grounds for the coastal command later in the war, because they knew, and the Germans knew, that the only ports those U-boats could go to were the ones that were waiting for them in France. But it was the war that they had to win, and Britain didn't cave in.
So, Dave, fascinating insights from Don and David there. Really grateful for the effort and work you put into bringing those to us. Fabulous content.
Yeah, well, my pleasure, Peter. It's only a small sort of token of what the New Zealanders contributed to Coastal Command and to the RAF during World War II, but it's really great to have the opportunity to tell some of their stories.
So, Dave, you've also managed to get some interviews with Coastal Command veterans as well for the Wings Over New Zealand podcast. Can you maybe give us just a quick insight into that and tell us where we can find out about those?
Yeah, sure. I've got a couple of interviews up on the site with Coastal Command guys, and they cover the two topics really that we covered in the episode, and that is 489 Squadron and 490 Squadron. If you look up Wings Over New Zealand Show episode 153, you'll find an interview I did with Philip Leach, who was actually an English-born member of 489 Squadron flying on the Bowfighters. So he's got quite an interesting story. And then the very next episode, episode 154, was with Stan Walker, who was a Kiwi pilot, and he was the last living member of 490 Squadron's aircrew, as far as we're aware. Unfortunately, passed away just over a year ago, but he flew the Sunderlands out of Africa.
Wow.
And he had a remarkable memory of everything too. A really interesting interview.
Yeah. Well, we'll put links to those in the show notes.
Sure.
Thanks very much. So that's Chapter 5, covering New Zealand crews in RAF Coastal Command. There'll be a short break now, and we'll return with the role of the adversaries when we talk U-boats and the Luftwaffe. Before we go, Dave, where can we find you and the Wings Over New Zealand online?
I can be found mainly on the Wings Over New Zealand forum. If you just Google Wings Over New Zealand forum, you'll always find me there. It's New Zealand's biggest aviation website online. And and I've also got the Wings Over Cambridge website, which is recording histories of people from my town who were in the Air Forces.
And on Facebook as well?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. You can find me through the Wings Over New Zealand show, which is my podcast, on Facebook, or you can just find me under Dave Homewood on Facebook.
Okay, you can find me, Nascot Hornet, on Twitter, and you can find Ellie, Tim and Gareth on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. Please leave us some feedback on this series and engage with us to debate the role of Coastal Command. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Dave Homewood.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.